taking up the question, going back a little bit to the Yetzias Mitzrayim, question was raised. We're not used to asking these kinds of questions because we're always dealing with the theories and the ideas and all of that. But you're supposed to view it as though you yourself had left Egypt. So a question has been raised, how would you have felt if you were actually there and if you were actually leaving? Try to imagine the emotional state. Would it have been a moment of joy, of happiness, of triumph, or would it have been to the contrary? Aren't there a lot of anxieties that you might... Did it require courage, for example? Because, well, first of all, you're going out there, all of your whatever possessions you have, you're taking with you, and you really, it's an unknown future. It's kind of an unknown future, of course, for the person of absolute faith. Obviously, that's a big factor. That's one type of thing. But the ordinary individual, I'd imagine, what are the Egyptians going to do? Maybe they'll come after us, and so on and so forth. So how would you respond to such a thing? I thought that that's a very good question, and immediately I start to focus on all the be realistic about it. It's easy for us to make light of it, so to speak, because God did this for you, God did that. Well, we're reading it from hindsight. Everybody's a genius in hindsight. You notice that. Whenever you tell people what you went through, so they didn't go through it, and then they have the advantage of seeing what happened, and they look back, well, why were you afraid? Why did you do it? Yeah, why? Because that's the way it is. I mean, a person is always, that's life. Life is the challenge, and life is always the element of the unknown. Usually when things are that crystal clear to you and you have no second thoughts, very often that's just because there's some very powerful emotion that's come to the fore and it doesn't work out the way you thought it would. It seems to me that this is something which had to have been addressed. That's the question. Was this addressed in the interactions between Hashem and the Jewish people? Or is that not even part of the story? Whatever the case, we're not interested in people's emotions, whatever. They got out and that's all that counts. Or was it indeed addressed? It seems to me that if you read the story, you will see that that this is an issue. Because how do you get a whole people? A whole people who had been pretty much assimilated into Egypt to agree to leave Egypt at that particular point in time and not be afraid. First of all, where are we going to? And what's going to happen just leaving? These people enslaved us and mistreated us, and we have no power against them. So who's to say that if we, what if this whole thing is a big trick and we can get into trouble and so on and so forth? There's all kinds of dangers that they might be concerned about. First of all, you therefore see that it didn't happen, well, it did happen overnight in a way of speaking, but from the time that Moshe returned to Egypt until the Exodus, we don't know exactly how much time. About a year, roughly speaking. That's about as close as we can get, that these events transpired within a year. That itself is significant, because it wasn't just a question of dealing with the Mitzrayim, it was winning the Jews back as well. And at first, that's why Moshe complained. At first, everything went backward. The initial response was to make the work harder, which was bad in and of itself, but it was devastating to the idea of Moshe being the leader and convincing them to have the confidence in him. Because that's what he urged them to, let's go to Paro and we'll ask for 3 days. That was the whole thing, to ask for 3 days to go worship God. So the initial reaction was something which was devastating, demoralizing. But from that point on, things began to change. So, first of all, there was the element of time that they had an opportunity to adjust, and their entire attitude to the situation underwent the change, because each one of the makos was a teaching instrument. It was directed against the Mitzrayim. This leads us to another question which we did take up over Pesach. I took it up with Rabbi Rosenthal, but I'm not going to deal with it directly now. It's sort of a side point as to whether the makos afflicted only the Mitzrayim, or whether it afflicted the Jews as well. I'm not taking up that question. It's a machlokas as to whether all of the Jews were exempted from all the makos. Clearly they were exempted from the major ones, where the Pasuk points it out. That, where's by the Deva, for example, that the animals of the Jews, by the Barad, by the Choshech, there are certain places, the Samti Padus, that God declares that there'll be a differentiation between what will happen to the Jews and the Egyptians. Thus, according to the Evan Ezra, from there you can deduce, if the Torah has to point it out in certain cases, then you have to deduce that in the other cases, for example, by the blood, by the Kenim, and so on, where the Torah does not point it out, then you should assume that it affected the Jews as well. Except the really powerful ones. I think he makes the point, for example, by the Arba, the locust which consumed the Yasser HaPleto, the whatever was left over, the last vestiges of the food supply, so to speak, the vegetation. There it does not point out that the Jews were spared. But I think the Evan Ezra makes the point that it didn't matter, for the Jews were leaving anyways, and it's not going to matter. So it didn't cause any harm to the Jews. However, the Rambam learns differently. The Rambam clearly says that that was one of the ten nisim that occurred in, there were ten makos occurred in Egypt, and ten nisim, ten miracles. And he makes a big point out of that in his commentary to Pirkei Avos, that, and we have a Kabbalah on this, we have a Masorah, that the Jews were spared from all of the makos. See, slowly but surely, the attitude of the Jews towards the Mitzrayim underwent a change. That is, they no longer would view them as being so invincible. Ultimately, the emotion of invincibility, which they would have attached to the people who were their former masters, that ultimately was destroyed at the Kriyas Yamsuf. But that doesn't mean to say that it wasn't, that's clearly, an important thing in the process was to begin that process of the opposite of the assimilation, to separate the Jews from the Jews had become assimilated. The Rambam makes that point, that they had strayed from the teachings of the Avos. Now that leads us into a separate question, that's another side question, as to the entire idea of the enslavement. Whether this was a punishment because the Jews had strayed, whether it was that kind of a thing, or whether there was some kind of a design, a divine plan that they should be enslaved. How do we understand the Bris Bein HaBsarim, where God says, Yodo Ateda, God tells them what's going to happen. Is that something that God is going to bring about because it must happen, even though the Jews did not sin? Or is that because the Jews did sin, and if so, what is the sin, and so forth? It's clear from the Rambam that the Jews strayed. And Kamat, he said, it almost reached a point where the entire foundation, the founding principles of the true idea of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the renunciation of Avodah Zarah, had become uprooted from them. And that's when God intervened and sent them Moshe Rabbeinu and so forth. So, the Jews had to be able to separate themselves from the Egyptians, mentally, psychologically, in terms of identification, and also to develop a certain amount of courage. Now, with that in mind, a lot of things take on more significance. For example, the request, we've mentioned this many times, the idea that the Jews would leave Egypt with great wealth, with rechush. So that has many facets to it, why that's important. At first glance, it doesn't, I mean, it's something that's nice, it's good to know, but it doesn't seem to be that important, but it is important in the story, and it keeps being mentioned many times. Hashem tells it to Avram, and then Hashem tells it to Moshe. This point, the Achrei Kedatel. But what's really, really important, this opened up a new idea, was the method in which this would happen, that the Jews were instructed to go to the Egyptians to make the request. As opposed to Moshe, it didn't happen that Moshe negotiated with Paro over this, or that anything like that occurred, but rather the Jews were instructed. The Jews had to go and confront the Egyptians and make these requests. and actually go through the experience of having them give them all of these gifts, tremendous amounts of gifts. So what is the point? What is the point of that? What is the point of that? That had to be an eye-opening experience, because the transformation of attitudes, the most devastating, debilitating thing is that you'll look down upon the inferiority complex, the slave mentality. All of this had to be uprooted. Otherwise, they can't move. Doesn't matter what's taking place. If a person has to have a certain amount of confidence in himself, he has to have a certain amount of self-worth, a certain amount of courage. Well, courage only comes from self-worth. If the person doesn't have any sense of self-worth, so whatever happens to him, it doesn't bother him. That's his mentality. People fight because what's happening to them violates their sense of dignity. That's a key factor, that there was a transformation of attitude. That the people, the attitude, this is one of the great miracles. That it's not recorded because it's not one of the Asamakos, but to me it's every bit as astounding. That is the complete transformation of attitudes. That this people that looked down upon them, by Yokutsum of Ibn Yisrael, they were the... That means to say that they were disgusted, so to speak. Is there, from the Jews, they found the Jews to be abominable, so to speak. A certain emotional distaste. We say that, we refer to that as being one of the punishments in the Kinos, on Tisha B'Av, Schiumos, that when they drove the Jews out of the tormentors, they drove them out of... Jerusalem, out of Israel, they referred to them like something which was vile and disgusting. That's always been a staple of anti-Semites, that they try to depict the Jew, not just that the Jew is a bad person, or a cunning person, or an evil person. That's one thing. That's not so, all right, so that's wrong, but when you hear people say that about you, that you're cunning and sneaky, whatever it is, that's one thing. But the fact that people find you to be disgusting, that's a different type of a... insult. And that transformation that God placed the chein ha'am hazeh, gam ha'ish Moshe, the fact, that's another factor, that the advent of Moshe Rabbeinu and the tremendous respect that people had, the Egyptians had a tremendous respect for Moshe Rabbeinu, that changed that. See, that has an impact upon the whole people. The psychological sense of the people is very, very much affected by their leaders, because they identify with their leaders, and when their leaders emerge and become international figures and gain respect, it has a tremendous impact upon the people. It affects everybody. You see that it's even to this day. I mean, you see it in American history, whatever, with the blacks, with people like Martin Luther King, and they get international recognition. So that elevates everybody, because you know you identify with him. Let's look at the factors. The Jews had to do something. They couldn't just be passive and be redeemed. That's an impossibility. Of course they could. I mean, I don't mean to say that God couldn't do it. It's just that that's not the way it works. That when miracles occur, God gives you the opportunity, but you have to seize the opportunity. It's never a miraculous transformation as we imagine it to be. It's always like, that's why I said, Kervanu. The Achshav of Kervanu. God brought us close. Close, but you've got to make the move. You're in a good position, but you have to access the opportunity. In addition to these actions, which imagine the effect on the Jew. He's got to be very, very nervous to go and ask the Egyptian for his finest jewelry and clothing. Even with your own friends, you feel hesitant. You don't like to ask. It's not comfortable, and so on and so forth. Imagine with strangers. And imagine not just with strangers, with your oppressors, with your tormentors. And you're going to go, and you're going to actually ask them. That itself requires a tremendous courage and a change of attitude. A change of attitude. You can't go, the slave is not going to go and ask for fine clothing. You're a slave. I mean, it's absurd. So already you see that they're not acting as slaves would act. But I think that the biggest transformation would be engendered by the Karban Pesach. Because that was, see, that's a stickler, that's a point. That's clearly a prominent element. The entire attitude, and this is a good thing, by the way, that the Egyptians, the Jews could never assimilate 100%. Could never assimilate 100%. As long as they retained any aspect of Jewishness, because the Egyptians worshipped the idols. They worshipped the for them the sheep was an abomination. Kol ro etzon. That's why the Jews had to be separated. There was an element of abomination about the Jew that goes back even to the time of Yosef. They remember when he had the party and they sat separately because the Egyptians wouldn't eat together with the Jews. They wouldn't break bread together. There was a, so that that is to say that there was a certain breach that couldn't be bridged. So the idea of openly even being a shepherd was problematic enough, that the Jews would be shepherds. What does that mean? That means that they're idle. The object which they used as a deity and which they made into an idol, the Jews worked, they were shepherds. That was their livelihood. So they lived in Goshen, fine. But that stigma attached to the Jew. For the Jews to go and take the Karban Pesach, Kicha Be'osar, there's many reasons why Rashi gives the reasons why they needed mitzvot and so on and so forth. But aside from that, doesn't it also have the practical benefit of the Jews are making a statement that requires tremendous courage to take that sheep on the 10th and to tie it up and to designate it as a carbon. That is to say, that's really sticking it to them. That the object which you venerate, we're gonna slaughter it and we're gonna sacrifice it. That's to say, it's really nothing. And we're gonna eat it. Why? Because it's good food. Nutrition, that's all it is. Now, when they did these activities, and nothing happened as a result, they didn't face any retribution. They didn't face any consequences. To the contrary, two things. The Egyptians themselves only demonstrated tremendous respect, or they gave them whatever they wanted. That was an extremely important thing. And then, of course, the Makas Bechoros. When they actually brought the carbon, and they sprinkled the blood, and there was that night of terror. I wanted to say also, there's a whole Ramban on this, as to that night, that no one should leave their house on that night. And the whole idea that, because sometimes the Torah refers to it as though they left at night. But then sometimes they left Mimachras HaPesach, on the day, the morrow of the Pesach is when they left. That is the morrow of the evening on which they brought the Karban Pesach. So the Ramban resolves the issue by saying that the Geula took place at night, that they were redeemed at night, but they didn't leave until the next day. And there was a reason for that. That is, Rashi brings down. Rashi says that Paro himself, whether Rashi means that literally, Rashi always does that, always takes it to the max, so to speak, like that Paro himself came down and they were, where's Moshe and Aaron? And pushing them to leave. But that's also a factor, the pushing them to leave. I spoke about that over Pesach. That it seems to me that the pushing them to leave, we discussed it from the standpoint of the miracle, the speed of the miracle, the haste of the miracle. But it seems to me that that also is a factor, that they were pressured. And maybe they needed that pressuring as well. Because maybe there was still a certain reluctance about leaving. I discussed that on one of the last days, about why, because the question I asked was, why didn't they sing Shira right at that, when they left? What about the miracle of leaving? What about the miracle of the Makas Bechoros? They didn't sing Shira. It was only after the splitting of the Red Sea. Basically, what I was saying was that perhaps that still in all, in spite of everything that had happened, they were ambivalent about Egypt. It's hard for us to see that because we weren't there. So it's easy to be philosophical about somebody else's emotions, like, oh, what could you possibly like about it? But you do have this, if it is true, which it is, that they'd been there for a few hundred years, and they had assimilated, and they were very reluctant, even though they were mistreated. There's always that attitude of reluctance to condemn the whole culture, and maybe people always want to find some good. I mentioned the fact that there are Jews even after the Holocaust that went back to live in Germany. So that perhaps there was that ambivalence. And on the one hand, of course, they were happy to be free, but were they entirely happy to leave this land? This was a great country. A person's been in a country, I mean, Russians that were in Russia, Germans that were in Germany, if they leave, but it's always an element of ambivalence, because, unless you always hated the place. But if, like America, if we, for whatever reason, had to leave America, we feel we have very positive feelings, we identify culturally, America's a great, great place. You clearly wouldn't be rejoicing. Let's say for whatever reason there was a government took over and it was dangerous and we had to get out. But we wouldn't rejoice. However, when you turn around and they're coming after you to wipe you out, that's a good, then you sing Shira. That is quite clear. That doesn't leave any room. What they experienced at Yamsov does not leave any room for ambivalence. I think there's one other point. I was talking about that idea that they didn't leave at night. And that in spite, that's the way the Ramban explains it, that in spite of all the pressure, Paro wanted them to leave immediately, not to wait, because of he wanted to get this torture over with and get them out of there. But perhaps that's also a factor. He said, we're going to leave in the morning, Biyad Rama, like in Royal. We're not going to leave like slaves in the night. So that's the plain shot. I'm saying it additionally, the reason is not what I'm going to say, but I'm saying, very often these things are multi-layered. They have more than one aspect to it, more than one element. I think that it also serves an additional purpose. Can you imagine how fearful it would be to leave at night? Nighttime is a scary time. It's scary. To ask them to leave at night, on a practical level, might have been very, very difficult. Because it's the nighttime and you don't know and you don't see. And it's a night of terror. There's all that screaming going on, and maybe they would be too fearful. However, in the morning they all gather together. Then you reinforce each other. That's a very important element, that they all left together in an organized fashion. Biyad Rama, it says, with a high hand. So each, on a practical level now, just addressing the ordinary, the mundane aspect, that would be different. To ask people to leave at night, where it's dark and you don't see who else is coming with you and all of that, and then you're afraid maybe there's an Egyptian waiting to hit you over the head, that's one type of thing. In the morning, it's clear. You can see the Egyptians, they're all completely preoccupied with their disaster. They're in no mood. You could see the devastation that's been wrought. You could see the mood. And then all the Jews are coming together from all different places, and that's part of the Jewish nation. You have to give strength to each other. Oh, so you see, together as a unit, then you derive strength from each other. Questions being raised pertaining to the idea that when Moshe tells Paro about the forthcoming Makas Bechoros, that there will be a tremendous scream throughout the land of Egypt. Ashekamo lo niyasa, that was never heard before. Uchamo lo sosef, and will never be experienced again. So that, of course, is the dimension. It's the slaying of the firstborn, but it's beyond that. It produces a certain type of a terror. That's the tzaaka, a certain night of terror, which will exceed anything which had ever happened before in history. The extreme terror of the night. Now, to contrast that, of course, ulechol bnei Yisrael, that this will, it has to be clear what the factor is. That this is from God, and it's directed purely at the Egyptians. And by contrast, L'chol b'nei Yisrael lo yecharatz kel l'shonam. Now the question, of course, is what's the plain pshat? It's an expression. The Evan Ezra says, lo yecharatz kel l'shonam sheyafchidem. That no animal, no dog anyway, will will frighten them. That's what it really means. Sometimes you're frightened by a dog the way it suddenly barks at you, whatever, you know, like it opens, it shows its teeth. So that's an aggressive move and it frightens you. And he's saying that no dog will even make a move, will even frighten them. He says that it means that they won't bite. That no animal, and dog doesn't mean just only dogs, it means no animal will even bite them. What I find difficult, though, is that why is that so significant if the Jews were going to be walking about that night? That's one thing, but they were instructed not to leave their houses at Boker. So if they're going to be at home, then it's hard to understand why that would be such a big thing. Now, the Eben Ezra says, V'yafki yishlach min ha-shamayim mashchas lahakos b'choreim. Then, in spite of the fact that God would send from heaven the destroyer to smite their firstborn. But the pasuk mentions that the animal will not sharpen its tongue or make an aggressive move against man or beast. Now, it's a good point is being made that normally when you have this kind of a situation, whenever there's a commotion, and especially which involves people screaming and terror and all that, dogs bark like crazy. And thus, they could, that itself would cause an additional fear, perhaps, the barking of the dogs. But it's also being mentioned that they will not, that this phenomenon won't happen against the Jews or their animals. The Chizkuni mentions a nice pshat. He says, L'yechretz kev l'shono, he says, minach ha-klovim linboach achachatzos. Well, he says that that's when they, to bark after chatzos. So he says, v'elu yashkimu, so he's tying it together to the Jews. He's saying, and but these, that is, the Jews are going to get up early, umaklam biyadam, and their staffs are in their hand. V'lo yinapchu achrayim. So that answers my question. That is, my question was, if the Jews are going to be at home, so what difference does it make whether the dogs will bark or won't bark? They're safely at home. Who cares? So what he's saying is that, but the Jews are going to be getting up very, very early. To leave. That's a significant thing. Again, it goes back to what we were discussing before. Put yourself in their position. That there's a certain fear. There's a certain fear that what's going on out there, people are dying, screaming, so there can be danger out there. So the fact that it'll be manifest in many, many ways that the Jews are in a situation of complete safety. Even their animals will not be affected, will drive home to them, well, to the Egyptians as well as to the Jews too. Now that we've isolated this point, that the Jews, you'd have to assume, also would be in a certain state of anxiety and fear. So on the one hand, you're creating a night of absolute terror from one side, but as far as the Jews are concerned, they will experience it as complete serenity, complete safety, that not even their animals will be subject, even to normal phenomena, that dogs normally would bark or whatever the case may be. Everything will be quiet as far as the Jews are concerned. What's interesting, though, is that Chazal attach a lesson to this. Because later on, when the pasuk says "Basa baso the trefa," the pasuk says "Ubasa baso the trefa lo socha," you should eat "Lakelav tashlichan oso," you should give it to the dog, cast it to the dog. The question: so, why does the pasuk have to tell you what to do with it? Who cares what you do with it? Why does it have to tell you to feed it to the dog? What if you don't have a dog? What's the point? You can't eat it. That's all that the Torah is interested in. There's no mitzvah here to feed the treif meat to the dog. Now, the Chazal mentioned that interestingly enough, they build upon that and conveying an idea that God does not withhold the reward of any being. And they're connecting it back to here, that this is the reward for the dog. That God instructed us to cast the meat to the dog, and this is a reward because of that, what took place on that night, that they didn't misbehave, so to speak. They didn't sharpen their teeth at the Jews. So that's a very hard thing to understand, as you can well see, because what do you mean? It's the reward. They chose to act in a certain way. They're purely instinctual beings. So according to this pasuk, it means that God worked it out, that they... that the animals were destroyed. However God worked it out, what difference does it make? It's not that the animals decided to be good and good boys or anything like that. On one level, this makes a lot of sense, that not in the simplistic sense of a reward, but it's as though it's a reward. That is, the reason why the pasuk told it to us is so that it's a teaching, that whenever you, now there's an association. If you should be in the field and you do come upon some meat which you can't use, so you might think then to just throw it away and get rid of it. But the pasuk is telling you, don't do that. Don't waste it. What you give it to the dog. So that, now, why the dog? First of all, you're learning an important lesson. You're learning an important lesson which has to do with the whole concept of Baal Tashchis, not to destroy things. Which most people live in a very self-centered universe, and they measure the value of things purely in terms of myself. So if they come upon some food, if they can eat it, fine. If not, what do I care? Just put in the garbage. Even though you wouldn't think that, well, maybe somebody else could use it. Okay, that's one level. But maybe, not you, but maybe an animal can use it. That's a, most people, the person that has pets and this and that is attuned, he might think of that. You find that certain people will save bread and they'll go feed the birds. What? In this situation, it's a higher level where a person humbles himself and makes this food available to an animal even. Why shouldn't the animal have it? But in this particular case, it's not just saying any animal. It's mentioning the dogs, like Kelev. So it calls to mind that phenomenon. It calls to mind the Chasdei Hashem. That is, so it's interesting that in all kinds of situations that you're in, even a situation like, there should always be a zecher. That's exactly the way the halacha operates in general, that when you see anything, when you encounter anything that should cause you to be humble and to become aware of the magnificence of the creation and go back to the Creator. So here it's a similar thing, except here it's not just going back to creation in general, but it's going back to Mitzrayim, to your humble origins. By giving it to the dog, you're reminding, so why the dog? Somebody will say, well, I'm looking for a dog. Why the dog? Oh, but you'll remember the pasuk. But then again, it makes you feel humble because you were in a situation where you were dependent upon the quote-unquote, the goodwill, so to speak, it's not really goodwill, of the dog. So you'll remember your own vulnerability. Now you're a big shot. Now you're distributing. See, you shouldn't. Maybe that's the idea. You shouldn't withhold the reward. You shouldn't withhold the reward. It's not a reward. It's not a reward in terms of theologically, like we look at reward and punishment, that the dog gets a reward. No. But you operate in that framework. See, when an animal does the right thing, people pat it on the back and give it a little reward. You see? So that calls to mind that situation, that on that night the dogs were well behaved, so to speak, so you give them the reward. In that sense, God doesn't hold back the reward. God doesn't hold back the reward, meaning that God is instructing you, through His creatures, that you should operate that way. Yeah, well, hope you feel better. You all right? You seem okay. Yeah?